Hi friends, this is Shadima, also known as the Type A Hippie, and this is the Type A Hippie podcast, SheCast episode 29. And I am here with Molly Welch Marhar. We met several weeks ago, Molly?
Yeah.
Over coffee, or over tea, I should say. And we have a lot in common. One of the biggest things is that we really want to eliminate, and the work that we do is to eliminate the stigma surrounding or attached to alcoholism, addiction, or substance use disorder. So on this podcast, we will use many of these terms interchangeably. And if Molly has any others, she'll throw them in the ring as well, just to confuse you just a little bit more. But all jokes aside, this is a really deadly disease, and it's now come to the forefront because of people like Molly, who are doing a lot of work and research around kind of the backstory of alcoholism and addiction or substance use disorder, in addition to some of the changing legislature and policies surrounding, in particular, opioid addiction, and the notion of the war on drugs from the 70s, 80s that we realized we kind of needed to change tune about that. So I will include in the show notes definitely how you can reach out to Molly, and then also a piece that I wrote about the war on drugs. And so, Molly, why don't you introduce yourself to listeners? And I'm so glad that you agreed to be on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for asking me. My name is Molly. I identify as a person in long-term recovery from heroin addiction, but also alcohol and all other substances. And that's kind of what I study now. I'm a graduate student at the University of Michigan at the Ford School of Public Policy, where I'm working on a lot of stuff. But my passion is opiate-addicted people, which is the term I use to refer to addicted people. I just like that one better, which we may or may not get into later. But I'm happy to be here. I work at a treatment facility, too. I'm a recovery support specialist, so my job is to basically be an ambassador for recovery for people who need it. And I'm excited to be here, so thank you.
That's awesome. Yeah, so why do you prefer the term addicted, opiate-addicted people?
Well, so lately, actually, I was just talking to you before now.
Sure.
About this paper I wrote about, I was writing about a large piece of the paper is talking about the public health perspective on addiction,
right,
which is kind of a new thing. Addiction was always kind of recognized, alcoholism was recognized by the AMA in the 50s, 1956, I think it was. And addiction was always kind of its like criminal younger cousin,
right. Absolutely.
And had, more stigma, arguably more stigma attached to it. In the 60s and 70s, the premier treatment was more opiates, was methadone. It kind of became a thing when veterans were returning. But it wasn't really a public health thing.
Sure.
Something that's kind of treated in hospitals maybe, but generally by social workers, in jails, in church basements with AA and NA meetings. And NA became big a couple decades after AA. So I like the term.
And so, friends, that's just 12-step recovery. So
12-step recovery, yes.
Right. AA is Alcoholics Anonymous, and NA is Narcotics Anonymous. And I will include some information about both programs in the show notes. So go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry, if you live in this long enough, you just start to, like,
take, totally. No. And it's all good. We're just bringing you all along for the ride. It's all good.
Yeah. So I like opiate-addicted people because I think it's a term that's, in NA, we refer to ourselves as addicts. And
sure.
AA, we refer to ourselves as alcoholics. And there's some literature out there written by, largely public health professionals that suggest that those terms are pejorative in some way. And I can understand how somebody outside of that community would see that addict as a pejorative term, but I think it's important to retain the language of the community. And then also, there's more clinical terms. Another thing we were discussing before,
sure,
this podcast, which have their place in, in the literature, and especially clinically. But I think that they can really distance the person from the disease.
Sure.
And also, there's some other issues I have, like with substance use disorder.
Mm-hmm.
being, you know, putting everybody on the same spectrum. You know, somebody who drinks a lot sometimes isn't necessarily afflicted in the same way as somebody who's an alcoholic.
Right.
And it can circumscribe the treatment options available to people if you're putting everybody on the same spectrum.
So. Yeah. No, that makes sense. I was just thinking when you were speaking that, you know, substance use disorder is a clinical term that clinicians use now attached to ICD-10, which is attached to insurance and billing, right? Mm. Because it goes back to money oftentimes. And not that all clinicians or all providers are solely fueled by money. However, many are. And the truth is, I remember working with a patient that was offended because in their chart, it had an issue of obesity, right? And that's a clinical term. It's not just someone wanted to be mean to someone else and write something. You know, there is an ICD-10 code that's attached to obesity, morbid obesity, you know, same thing with substance use disorder. So to your point, it can, just like all diabetics are not necessarily the same in terms of their, I work in primary care and we don't use the word compliant, like non-compliant, compliant, because a lot of times patients are put in a, you know, in a hole, if you will, and characterized or mischaracterized as being non-compliant, meaning they don't listen to their provider, they don't do what they're supposed to do, they don't take their medications, you know, and it really becomes like a punitive relationship rather than a mutual respect relationship, and the doctor doesn't necessarily know more just because they're more educated, you know, or more educated in this arena because the patient is the one living with the disease, you know, and so tapping into their lived experience, right, is incredibly important. And I think that when Molly and I had met initially and I thought we were meeting about something completely different, and then we just started talking, and you all know I'm an introverted talker, and so I can talk with a lot of different people about a lot of different things, and I love that I do have a connection to humanity. And we started talking about the war on drugs and some of the policy that's in place, especially with this newer administration. And so I watched the film The Anonymous People, and it was really eye-opening for me personally, and it was emotional for me as well. And I'll tell you why. One of the things that stood out to me was that people that are thriving or are in long-term recovery are often your neighbors, you know, members of your family, members of your faith community, your colleagues at work, and you don't even know. You only know when they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, and when they come in reeking like booze, or you see tracks on their arm, or they don't show up to work, because this epidemic, whatever you want to call it, right, costs the community money in many, many ways, right? It costs the community money in terms of medical care. And treatment options. It costs the community money in terms of lost wages and people not showing up for work or showing up late and you needing to term people but having to do it in an appropriate manner so that you don't get sued. It shows up in benefits that are being used, and that ties into the clinical piece. And it shows up in some criminal behavior also. That has to also be a part of the conversation, but it doesn't look like what we often think it looks like, right? So what would you say about all of that, Molly, in terms of kind of what you're studying at the Ford School of Public Policy, and then just kind of how, depending on where you stand with the current administration, there are a lot of things changing and pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And so the thing that stood out to me was just kind of, if you don't share your own story, then a story will be told about you, kind of thing. And then just back in the Reagan years, the war on drugs, like that was Nancy Reagan's pet project, similar to former First Lady Michelle Obama's, like, let's move and healthy eating and all of that stuff. Former First Lady Nancy Reagan, it was about the war on drugs along with her husband. And so I know that you have a lot of opinions. Molly's sweet and spicy like me, and so she has
thank you.
A lot of opinions about this, and so would love to hear what you think about some of that and kind of where we are today. So, like, going backwards to go forward.
So I think the first thing I want to touch on is I love diabetes as an analogy for addiction because I think there's a lot of parallels there.
Sure.
You know, like, I think for the most part, the best treatment for a diabetic is a change, a behavioral change, a change in, you know, what they eat, a change in how they, you know,
move their body,
move their bodies.
Totally.
And my mother-in-law is a diabetic, and I guess you would term her as probably a, like, or you wouldn't because you don't call them non-compliant, but she's on that end of the spectrum, right? And I often get frustrated, and I have to reflect on that because it's very much the same type of thing that you see with addicted people. And, but the piece that I want to extract from that is that the best treatment is a treatment that emphasizes a change in behavior.
Sure.
Right? But I think in, you know, speaking to the current administration, the Trump administration, honestly, I feel like substance abuse treatment, personally, I think that's one of, like, the lesser concerns at this point. But the last administration, you know, I think it's important to make a move towards destigmatizing.
Yeah.
The problem is it's relying on this narrative. And the narrative is, and I'm speaking mostly with regard to opiate addiction.
Sure.
Because there's this quote-unquote opioid epidemic, largely brought about by the pharmaceutical industry, right? They're, you know, there's been an increase in prescription pain medication. And it's been pretty egregious. You know, the Purdue Pharmaceutical, who manufactures OxyContin, they were, like, actually sued for misbranding the drug, right?
Absolutely.
And then within a week, the FDA approves the prescription of OxyContin to children ages 11 to 16. So there's, like, it seems like the left hand and the right hand are doing different things, right? So I appreciate the administration moving forward and trying to make these criminal justice reforms. But it goes back to this narrative of people overdosing on prescription medication. The people who are addicted to opiates are distinctly whiter, richer,
right.
A lot of times older, and maybe even younger too, you know? And
yeah.
So there's this narrative about this kind of privileged class dying from overdose. And, like, the problem with that is twofold. Like, first of all, it's about death.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you look at the legislation that was passed, the CARA bill, like the Comprehensive Addiction Recovery Act, that's, like, the major one, the solutions focus on mitigating death, not so much enhancing life. And so it expands access to medication, which is a viable treatment option. I'm not here to talk smack about methadone or Suboxone. But it does that to the exclusion of other behavioral treatments, right?
Right.
Where, you know,
and lasting treatments, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're a person in long-term recovery, and I know plenty of people, right? And so it does pose a problem. Like, if we're speaking frankly, you know, and again, this is no disrespect to anyone that has found that that treatment plan works for them. That said, many 12-step recovery programs believe in complete abstinence, you know, and getting yourself there. And so seeing these behavioral changes, to your point, is incredible. And that's where a lot of people have seen. I mean, and friends, not just hundreds of people, not just thousands of people. So way more than that over years, like over a decade, right? At least in AA, over a decade. And I think in NA as well. But I don't know the numbers for NA. I don't know when NA was founded, but I know when
AA
was founded.
For a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
The 30s?
Yep, exactly. It has been the 30s.
Well, and then that's where, like, the anonymity becomes problematic, maybe. Because, like you were saying, the only thing that you see, if the person is an alcoholic or an addict in recovery, the only thing that you see is when they're messing up, you know? And I think anonymous people did a really great job of making the argument about how important it is to display the positive side of recovery.
Right.
But in my opinion, that recovery advocacy movement kind of fell short of really extolling the virtues of abstinence, right? Because your brain can't really recover from opiate addiction if you're ingesting opiates or opiate agonists. If you're plugging those receptors, is your brain going to be able to recover? Are you going to be able to be emotionally stable? And then there's other evidence, too, like physician health programs are wildly successful. And they're abstinence-based. They're 5 years. There's an emphasis on follow-up. When people relapse, they follow up with more treatment, not less treatment resources, which is a lot of what you see when people relapse is, oh, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. You get no more treatment.
Right.
Instead, there's the opposite response. But it's only really been studied in physicians, and like there's, you know, this classist, elitist argument about how they have more at stake. But don't tell me a physician who's about to lose his license has more at stake than a mother who's about to lose their children.
Right.
That's just not true.
Right.
But you don't see in, you know, the Surgeon General's report talking about addiction, they call abstinence-based treatments scientifically unsound. But they don't really talk about physician health programs. Mm-hmm. It's really ridiculous. Well, and then the other side is this, the whiteness and this whole narrative about what opiate addiction looks like. And so basically, it expands access to these medication-based treatments like methadone and Suboxone. And the people who can afford other treatments pay for these long-term abstinence-based treatments. They recover this cognitive capacity. So basically, all these people who aren't a part of that rich white narrative are relegated to the shitty treatment.
Right. It's all good.
Yeah. Relegated to methadone. Which,
We swear on this podcast, so it's okay.
And I'm showing my colors. I'm biased against methadone. I've been on methadone. I think it's shitty. But, and maybe it's not. It works for some people.
But that's your lived experience.
Yeah. But I think the important part is that the people relegated to these expanded access treatments that are largely medication don't have the choice to do something else. And that's, I think, the important piece.
Yeah.
And not the piece that's just my opinion, you know.
Totally. Yeah, no, I mean, and it's no different. Like, one of the things in Anonymous People was a woman who is, I would say, a double winner. She's in long-term recovery from alcoholism, and she also is a survivor of breast cancer. And so, you know, she would have her check-ins, right, and her checkups, and then mark time of being cancer-free. So the first year, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth was a big deal because she's now 5 years away from the actual disease, you know, and continue to check in 5 year increment. Well, check in periodically and celebrate the 5 year increments of being cancer free, you know. And so many people do find that when they are connected in community, whether it's a 12-step program that's abstinence based, along with the behavioral changes that you were talking about and we were talking about in terms of both cancer, right, or diabetes or GERD or like any clinical disease state, if you are diagnosed with that, there is generally a conversation with your provider to talk about what's next, you know, what are next steps, where do we go from here, and what do you need to do, you know, because there needs to be some sort of buy-in, because it's you, not me, you know. I've sat with patients and I say, you know what, you could probably write a book on this. Why aren't you doing it? You know, like, what is getting in the way of you taking your medication, or what is getting in the way for you to make it to us, or why aren't you making it to dialysis? You know, these are big, they're big questions, and you hold the answer. So when it comes to substance use disorder or addiction or alcoholism, you know, what do you think that people can be doing if they want to be activists in this movement, so to speak, or if they want to advocate for other people? What is it that we're not doing that we could be doing, and what is it that we are doing that we should probably refrain from doing moving forward?
So it's a question I wish I had an answer to, right? Because I'm in this spot right now where I have lots of thoughts and opinions about things, and also a lot of information to back most of them up, right? And so I write about it, and I study about it, and I talk about it. But short of doing that, it's like, how do you get a movement going? Mm-hmm. And there's some good recovery advocacy going on in Washington County that you spoke, I think, with Ashton from, you know, RAP. So,
yeah,
you know, they're doing cool stuff there. But I'm kind of a little on the margins of that because I'm, you know, kind of I'm a little bit of an extremist on my opinions. So for me, what activism looks like is writing, talking. You know, I speak when I have the opportunity to.
Sure.
So I thank you for this opportunity.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I present my work where I can, but it's difficult. Mm-hmm. One of the projects I'm involved with is called the Unicorn Project, which, I mean, my coworkers actually, and then a guy who works at the University of Michigan. All of us are kind of in the recovering community and in long-term recovery from opiate addiction. We kind of, it wasn't my idea, it was my coworker Ross's idea, but we kind of fleshed it out, and it's the Unicorn Project, and what we're doing is showcasing stories of people who've achieved long-term abstinence from opiates of all kinds, mm-hmm. Through abstinence, because, you know, the prevailing belief, and the one that I think is politically expedient for a number of reasons, you know, and I could, like, talk about my, like, paranoid theories about Big Pharma, but maybe another day.
Sure.
You know, it's politically expedient, though, to have medication be the answer. You know, mm-hmm. it's easy. And so, you know, people who don't choose that route are, like, we're unicorns. We don't exist, right? But we do, and there's a lot of us, especially in this community. So it showcases the stories of people from this community.
Nice.
Who found recovery that way. And, you know, we are a community that's particularly friendly to that, mm-hmm. with the treatment facilities around yeah. here, the recovering community around here. But William White and others talk about this idea of, like, a healing forest.
Sure.
And there being, you know, how do you save a dying tree? Well, you could fertilize a tree and take care of the tree, but if it's in a dead forest, it's not going to do much better.
Sure.
It kind of speaks to what you're talking about the importance of community.
Yeah.
But if you transplant that tree in a healing forest, it will thrive.
Totally.
So kind of just what I've been doing in terms of activism is trying to showcase what I've seen work, because a lot of it boils down to this idea of this term that I kind of hate. It's called evidence-based, right?
Mm-hmm.
Evidence-based treatment.
Sure.
But what that generally means is, like, based on the evidence that people have seen fit to collect, and oftentimes that's not the stories
sure.
of recovery. It's well, not the lived experiences.
That's
it's,
right.
you know, RCTs of new drugs.
Yeah. Well, and it's, so I'm with you in terms of, I mean, I'm going to med school. I don't know exactly when, but I will be going to med school. I will become a doctor, and so I will likely prescribe medication. However, that's not going to be my first choice, you know, because I don't think that that needs to be the first choice in every case scenario. And I'm an essential oils person, so I'm definitely a hippie, and I definitely feel like there are other options before medication, pharmaceutical medications. And yet I know that there's room for that. You know, I got involved in a really bad car accident in May of last year, and it's a miracle that I walked away from it. I'll tell you that right now. And I am glad that professional medical, you know, like emergency medical technicians, like EMTs, paramedics, firefighters, were police officers were at the scene. I'm glad that they did what they do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not at that moment requesting essential oils, you know what I mean? If I need a heart transplant, God forbid, you know, that is something that Western medicine, emergent medicine, is going to be helpful for. And then the rehab, you know, I'll use the oils, you know. So there's room for each of these different ways to do something, you know, different treatment. My loving life coach always says, just because someone does something differently doesn't mean it's wrong, you know? And it's really a good reminder that there are different ways, and not, I mean, if you're not asking the right questions, right, you're not going to get the answers. So if you're not in touch with the recovery community, you're not going to get lived experience and evidence that you so desperately seek. And so you are going to paint a picture or write a narrative that may or may not be consistent with the truth and reality. And so everyone who listens to my podcast knows I'm anti-alternative facts. So, like, get your facts straight, you know? Ask the questions. Do the work. It is possible, and it's absolutely necessary, because people are dying. That is a fact, right? And many people are living, and not just surviving, they're thriving in recovery. And so that gets lost, you know, when we have these kind of, like, these documentaries that are great, and it's great, but I'm not big on the word is escaping me. And as soon as I hit stop for the recording, it will come to me. But almost like soap opera-ish, like that kind of notion of like we have to scare, like scared straight, like that is not really the best course of it, you know?
Fear mongering,
you know, I'm wearing my tank top that says love is greater than fear. It's like, if we actually take a look, right, at the situation in front of us and see, okay, what does this really look like? And what is this really saying? And how does this speak to me? And what do I need to do? Just my part, not everyone's part, just my part. It's like, for me, my part is the podcast. Like, in part, I do a lot of other stuff behind the scenes, but the podcast is probably the most public thing that I do with regards to eliminating stigma, because it's important. And I talk to people in recovery because I believe we're all in recovery from something, and everyone needs to be, you know? The world flows a lot better when people start taking care of themselves and are not so worried about what someone else is doing that has no bearing on their life, but what do you need to do to, you know, help yourself today? Because when you're more well, as a community, we're all more well, right? There was one question that I had for you, and now it's escaping me. I like the idea of the Unicorn Project, though. I like the name of it.
Yeah, you can visit us at www.unicornsreal.org.
Awesome.
And just then, a bunch of bios, but it's awesome. And then, you know, we talk about in the top right corner, there's like a menu. And we have, you know, we talk about a model that works, which, to go back to the physician health program,
sure,
model, you know.
No, that's awesome. I did want to ask you, Molly. So in between, I kind of have said this a lot lately, that I vacillate between self-care and being an activist, or self-care and being a thorn in the sides of my elected officials. I emailed Senators Stabenow and Peters today because I need to do their damn job. And so I gave them some of my thoughts. And how do you self-care? What do you do when you're not thinking about the addicted community, when you're not writing papers for school, when you're not thinking about graduating? And just next month, friends, she will be done next month, which is so exciting. I'm so proud of you. So what do you do in your spare time when you're not doing the work?
Well, so my husband's in recovery, my
sure
partner. I like to refer to him that way.
Yes.
And we had a daughter. We have a daughter, but I had her about 5 years ago, so she's five. So I guess that's how I unwind, is spending time with him. But, you know, I like live in that. I work in that. My friends are all in recovery. So I guess when I'm working around, it doesn't really feel like work.
Sure.
It's just kind of, but like the self-care piece is something that I learned by being an addicted person in recovery, is like, you know, I work a 12-step program, so that's my self-care piece, and hanging out with my friends who are in recovery, and you know, like I went out for dinner and did like a lead last night in a meeting, and it was fun, and it was like a spiritual thing, and you know, I was being of service. I think being of service is really important to
sure
like my personal journey, although it's not always like going and volunteering at, you know, the
soup
kitchen,
right,
but like I've done that and I love that. But yeah, being of service, I think, is one of my favorite ways to unwind, because that's where I get a lot of spiritual spiritual food, you know? But,
cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. So what's next after graduation, do you think, for you?
To be honest, I just need a job.
I
have a job.
It's hiring.
Yeah. I need a job, but you know what? I think, so my plan, my 5-year plan. I really need to get some more skills, right? I have ideas and
sure
information even, but I want to just get in there and develop some more skills. And I think what I really want to end up doing is becoming like a more formal advocate
sure
for long-term absence-based treatment, maybe and probably in conjunction with the treatment facility that I work with, because I really, you know, I think I work for Dawn Farm, and they endeavor to emulate that long-term abstinence-based treatment model, and kind of, you know, and they're renowned for it.
And that's part of why this healing forest that we have here is so rich. So I really believe in what they do. I went through there a couple of times. but I see myself. Yeah, it's stuck.
You know, and it's stuck at a certain point because you had the resources to go back through, you know. And yeah, I mean, you touched on race and, you know, culture and class, because these are important pieces. And there's this idea of intersectionality, right? And Ashton and I talked about it a lot. And I love the policy folks, like public policy folks and social work folks and public health people, because academically they're reading, you know, they're reading this work, whereas me being a woman of color, I live it, you know? So I can do the reading, yes, but I live it and I speak about it because, you know, the war on drug disproportionately affected people of color. And some of those people of color, President Obama released a significant amount of people, but I do believe that there are still some people incarcerated for crimes that they, more on the petty side, crimes that they committed as a result of being drug addicted. Back in the 70s, you know, in the 80s when that war on drug was strong. Whereas now the shift in focus is because of who is now the addicted person, you know, and so that's probably another episode in the future. Yeah. We'll probably have you back, Molly.
There's a great article in The Roots. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'll try to send, I can't remember what it was called, but it was
very related to that.
Yeah, stinging about that. And I think that it's, you know, it's hard to ignore that, right? Because the reality is, you know, the number of people who are jailed and imprisoned for drug-related crimes is totally not representative of the number of people who are doing that, right?
Right. And or the actual census, like the population in the United States.
Yeah. So, but also, I mean, if you take the population of people doing drugs, you know, still a majority of them are white and like it, you know.
Totally.
I mean, I don't have the figures in front of me.
Right.
Enough to know that.
Yeah.
And the, you know, and a thing, a piece of that though is like there's the policing piece too that you can't completely remove from that. I mean, it's. Possession of heroin and cocaine is still a felony, at least in the state of Michigan. Mm-hmm. I don't know of any states where that's not the case, but, you know, like I said, I don't have that information in front of me. So, I mean, we can release as many people as we want, but while possession is still a felony, a felonious crime, because you possess a drug that you're addicted to because you have the disease of addiction, like, you know, that's...
Yeah.
There's, you know, we have miles to go.
Yeah, no, we definitely do. And now, with the current administration, I don't know if you heard this, a southern state... They passed a law saying that if you resist arrest, even if it's an illegal arrest or it's a erroneous arrest, that is now a felony.
Resisting
arrest, even if you were not supposed to be arrested, like is a felony, and so it's called like it's something along the lines of like. Kind of like a Blue Lives Matter type of, like, no, it's considered a hate crime if you resist arrest.
Oh, my gosh.
So that is definitely another conversation for another time. Oh, yeah. We could probably talk about
that. Because I worked as a public defender, and I can't tell you how much paperwork I processed where the only charge was RNO, resisting and obstructing. I'm like, of course they're resisting and obstructing. You're arresting them for no reason. You haven't charged them with anything else. It's insane.
It's yeah, we definitely have room to grow. And it's funny because I posted... There's a little black boy and a little white boy, and the white boy wanted to have the same haircut as his black friend. And so his parents took him to the barbershop, and he got a fade, like it's all gone, right? And he says, now my teacher will know that we're twins. Like, and they just didn't have the concept that they're not twins, and even though they're here, you know. And one of my friends wrote, Gina, she said, I love the simplicity of it. I said, yeah, I believe that little people, that's what I call children, are closer to the divine. I feel like that about pets too. You know, there's something that happens when children grow up and then they become adults, and now we're not as close to God as we once were. And, you know, this notion of colorblindness was kind of the, you know, and I don't believe in that because
it's not true, and it just doesn't make any sense. Yet, I will say that no one slides down the birth canal racist, right? Mm-mm. This is learned behavior. No one slides down the birth canal sexist, you know, same thing, or prejudice, like all of these things. And so there's definitely more room for growth, especially when it comes to kind of this duplicitous lifestyle that we, a lot of us have embraced, where it's like, it's us versus them, or, you know, when I say I am you and you are me, and what pains you pains me, and not in a codependent, unhealthy way, but just in a, okay, Molly is struggling right now, why is she struggling? And that becomes something that I care about because it is a struggle for you. Then we have more room for growth and we can move in a more positive way. Like if I say, oh, this person's addicted, so it's not really them. Because if someone has cancer, we don't feel sorry. I mean, we feel sorry for them. If someone announces, I have this kind of cancer, with the exception of lung cancer, which people still ask the stupid question, well, did they smoke? At this point, doesn't really matter. They have lung cancer, you know? But if someone says, like, I'm an alcoholic and I need help, people are viewed very differently, you know? And so that is part of it. But if I say, if someone says, oh, Chidima, I was just diagnosed with cancer, and I've been on the other end of the phone when some of my friends have told me that, and it's devastating. It's not about me, and yet I'm devastated on their behalf, right? But it's like, okay, well, what do we need to do? What do you need, you know? Do we need to be on duty for you? Like, do you need a ride to chemo? Or if you're opting out of chemo, like, what other support do you need? Do you need food, like, frozen in your fridge, you know, so that all you have to do is take it out, thaw it, and pop it in the microwave or in the oven? Like, what do we need, you know? And that is not the response when people say, I need help. It is, what did you do? What's wrong with you? Why are you like this? No one else is like this in our family.
Or just stop.
Or just stop, exactly. Which isn't a thing, friends. So please don't say that to people if they're reaching out to help. It's like when someone wants to end their life and they're experiencing suicidal thoughts or ideation. It's not a just don't do it. That's not a thing. So please, I'm big on like highlighting stupid questions because I believe that there are stupid questions and stupid statements. So just stop is not a great one. So just please don't say that to anyone that has the courage and boldness enough and has attempted to overcome their fear to tell you that they need help. And please don't ever respond to them like that because it's not really helpful at all. So I think we are nearing the end of time. Well, not all of time, but our time together.
We hope, right?
I hope. So thank you so much.
No, thank you
for being
awesome here.
Really appreciate it. So friends, we are going to read a couple stories from the Humans of New York stories. So there is an older gentleman, from what I can gather, and he says, people have been waving at me lately. I think my daughter may have put my picture on the Facebook, he said, which I think is so cute.
That's so cute.
Right? And then there are two girls. It says, sometimes my mom grounds me because of my attitude, which gives me a bad attitude. Sounds normal. They seem like teenagers. And then there's another guy. It says, things are going good for me. I got a new job. I've just got to be better about my drinking. It's not even really about the drinking for me. It's about the loneliness. I go to a restaurant or bar because that's where the people are. Then if I'm at the bar, I've got to have a drink. Then the next thing I know, I'm drunk. Then the next morning, I'm 2 hours late for work because I got on the subway going the wrong way. I've lost a lot of jobs because of my drinking. And then he's asked how many, and his response, about 7. I honor the place within you where the entire universe resides. I honor the place within you of love, of light, of truth, of peace. I honor the place within you where when you are in that place in you, and I am in that place in me, there is only one of us.
So friends, thanks for listening. I hope to hear from you soon. Thank you always for the support. My name is Shadima, also known as the Type A Hippie. Namaste.
Namaste.